Well, hello everyone, I'm Rick Stasloff, and welcome again to another edition of the Strategic Finance Learning Studio. I'm joined today by my great friend and colleague, Scott Carlson, a senior writer with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Rick, how are you?
I am doing great. Thanks for joining me today for what I know is going to be a fascinating conversation. Our topic today is not going to be the election, but in the shadow of the election, Scott and I thought it was a good time to take a step back and think about the impact on higher ed, not from who gets elected, but more from the public and the public's good. And what's the job that higher ed might be giving itself going forward? So Scott, you and I have already talked about how there are moments in the past that we all reach back to, right? The GI Bill, moving the needle on gender and race, on lifting up women and students of color. They were jobs higher ed gave itself, right? Sometimes from a policy perspective, other times because of who was involved in higher ed. So what job does higher ed give itself now?
That's an interesting question. I mean, certainly you could look at the political landscape and think that higher education has a huge job in, you know, helping the country understand complex issues and understanding debate and understanding the role of civic institutions, you know, sort of all of these kinds of roles that higher education has had in the past in terms of sort of civilizing us in a way. And I think we need to be civilized again. But I was thinking earlier as we were contemplating this discussion between the two of us, and I was thinking about the Romans and what the Romans used to do to keep everyone in line, and that was to provide bread all the time. And, you know, what's the bread of modern society? It's really a job and a salary, and it's increasingly difficult for some families to get that. And that function of training people for the workplace does increasingly fall to higher education. And maybe that really is the big public service that higher education will be providing, perhaps more explicitly in the future. I mean, right now, you know, higher education has tied itself to economic development. It has tied itself to this job training environment. It does market itself as, you know, come to this college and we'll train you up, and X percent of our students get a job right after college, and, you know, they earn X number of dollars per year. I mean, it's in all the marketing material. It's in the way that the college leadership talks about itself. And yet colleges, as you know, are pretty conflicted about this role, right? I mean, at one level, they're touting all of this work that they do to sort of set people up with careers and jobs and a quote unquote good life, right? The whole Gallup polling is around this kind of stuff. And yet in higher education itself, you know, the notion that you're just training people for jobs, the notion that you're just serving a vocational function is really not only dealt with uncomfortably by some people, but it's even rejected by some. I think given that we are only 12 years after a recession that was devastating to this country, and now we're in another economic downturn from the coronavirus, and we've seen the evaporation of wealth from families in those events. And in general, we've seen a decline of family wealth basically since the 1970s. I think it's absolutely the case that there will be more public pressure from students and families, but also from public policymakers and so on, to make the connections from higher education to the job market more explicit. Now, I want to talk with you a little bit about this because I think there are right ways and wrong ways to do this. What do you think about that, Rick?
Well, as a call to action, I mean, that seems big, right? Hey, come to college, but we're going to help set you up for a pathway into the next chapter of your life. And something that, you're right, from students, parents, policymakers, governors, legislators have been calling for this for some time. So it certainly seems like something big that would have, quite frankly, a societal impact and could correct what has been the erosion of the value proposition, as you know, in higher ed for some time, certainly back to 08, but even before that, where students are saying, I'm not sure it's worth not only my money, but my time. So that feels big, and it also feels doable. Your point, though, about this sort of split opinion within higher ed, on the one hand, we say, oh, we'll help you. On the other hand, we say, but that's not really what we're about. It seems like there would have to be some kind of culture shift within higher ed to really bring that about, wouldn't there?
Well, I think, that culture, those two different kinds of cultures are happening in different parts of the university, yeah. Right? I mean, I feel like the administrative side and the staff side is all about, this is about career, this is about launching, making money, and so on. And they're touting that without necessarily supporting the functions there, and at some cases and at some institutions. On the other side, you do see faculty who have these very close contacts to students, people who did sort of pursue their passion and, you know, got into these careers that are, they're very much tied to what they really wanted to do, what their real interests were, and conveying that interest to these students, and yet them feeling, I think the faculty do feel conflicted that they don't want to just sort of convey information that's just used for a job and then forgotten. I think, you know, the human part of that is that they want to convey something lasting, and they understand that, you'll get your job after college, and then you'll get another job, and then you'll get another job, and they won't necessarily be related, but they're hoping to provide, as Peter Furcho did for me at the University of Minnesota, teaching me about, you know, utopian and dystopian literature. You know, what was the job application for, you know, reading Aldous Huxley and George Orwell? You can't really think of one, right? At the same time, you know, isn't that extremely relevant? You know, thinking about Orwell in 1984, thinking about Huxley and Brave New World, and, you know, the interaction between a population and a government, isn't that extremely relevant in the last several years, if not, you know, in the 25 years since I've graduated from college? Sure. So yeah. It's huge.
Yeah, no question. Unlike when we went to college, I was there a few years before you, though, it seems like there'd have to be even greater intentionality, right? So if we're going to give students these skill sets, right, and broad skill sets that can help them in a lifetime of learning, seems like we've got to create better pathways for them. And there are some instances at colleges, right, where we have industry councils, right? In certain programs and departments, there's connections out into the world of work, but it's pretty ad hoc, right? And usually it's up to that chair or that dean to go after something like that.
It's ad hoc, and it's not for very many industries itself, right? I mean, engineering would be one where you'd see a lot of companies coming and trying to recruit engineers. You know, you might see that with nursing or other kinds of healthcare occupations, right? Where are the recruiters for history majors? Where are the recruiters for German language majors? You know, and yet those skills are needed. You know, the employers talk all the time about how they want students who have these broad skills and these broad ideas about how the world works. But, you know, there isn't really a recruiting function there. So I think the colleges need to make, yes, those paths explicit. Not in a way where they're sort of setting up the pathway ahead of time. Okay, become a history major and then take this writing course and then do this and do this, and all the history majors should pass through this. I think it should be more of an individualized thing where, you know, as I've written about with Ned Laff, you know, in the Chronicle about the importance of academic advising, you know, these academic advisors, these counselors at colleges, even these professors and staff members maybe who are not in the advising function, connecting with students on campus, asking them, what are you interested in? What do you really want to do? Oh, you're a German major, you're an English major. I understand how I can connect that to a career, and let me help you out with that. I mean, alumni could be involved with this as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all sorts of options and sources out there. The thing is, do it, make it explicit. I mean, as a friend of mine had said about the college experience, a lot of it is you come to college, you take the courses you're going to take. And then, you know, when you're about to graduate, they hand you the alumni card, they pat you on the back, and then out the door you go. And then you kind of get out there and say, well, okay, what do I do now? You know? And I think there needs to be more of this setting up the pathway right after college, and then maybe a place where the students who have graduated from college can come back again and again and ask more questions. How do I transfer this? How do I make this work into a different kind of major or a different kind of life?
Yeah,
I think that's valid.
Well, I love this idea of higher ed being the bridge and making it part of the pipeline, right? Part of what good looks like, part of what success is, and it's not ending at the completion and the degree award. But it seems to me it could tap into student hunger for more, internships, clinical, other kinds of real world experiences, right? Where they're already connecting into the world of work right at the very start.
Well, yeah, and investment is a huge thing for a lot of these colleges, but you have to think that that would pay off tremendously over time. I mean, you think about how many students do we graduate from four-year institutions? It's what, 2 out of 3? So a third of them are basically dropping out. Isn't that kind of the national average, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and why do those third drop out? I mean, think about the people I know that sort of quit college early. They were sort of saying to themselves, yeah, I've been flailing here for a while. I don't really understand what the point of this is. I just don't get it. Like, I don't get what I'm driving toward. And they lose interest and they go get a waitressing job, or they work as a bartender, or they get a job with an uncle or whatever. And then they might come back and leave and come back and come leave and leave. So I think if colleges were able to say, hey, no, stick it out here. You're in your sophomore year, you go 2 more years, we can show you how this leads to where you're going. I think the retention rates would probably improve, and certainly the student satisfaction would improve, and the students launching would improve, which all would indicate if the other pieces of the puzzle were in line, they would increase their retention rate and then get more money out of that. But then also engender a lot of goodwill among alumni who would be more willing to give. I think a lot of this stuff would pay off over time.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there's a great connection to the business model, which creates more sustainability for that investment. You're right, around student stay, they take more credit hours, that drives net revenue, they graduate faster on time, that lowers the cost per completion, so all of your success metrics improve, and the overall outcome and resources coming back to the institution could get better. So it seems like, interestingly, you and I talk a lot about public goods, private goods, right? And, that idea that going back to the 50s, 60s, et cetera, higher ed was a public good. An educated citizenry helped everybody. And so it was worth all citizens investing in it. And how we've shifted since, I guess, really the 1980s to a private goods model. Well, invest in yourself. It's good for you. You'll earn more over your lifetime, but we don't think about it from a civic perspective. You're kind of hijacking the private goods model. Come here, invest in yourself. It's good for you. But because of connecting to the world of work, it actually brings it back to a public good idea, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, and especially if you think that, people are happier if they're living fulfilled lives. If they're making more money, or they're making, the amount of money that's appropriate to their ability. But more than that, they are going somewhere every day where they feel fulfilled, where they feel like they're making a difference, or they're playing off the strengths that they have. I mean, that's very powerful. And I think a lot of what occurs in culture happens because of the places where we work. I mean, we talk about the liberal arts being something that deepens a person and provides different perspectives, maybe provides empathy, teaches people how to communicate, and so on. And I think all of those are true. However, I think that you're basically in the college sphere, you're sort of seeding that in the student. It's really in the workplace where a lot of that stuff starts to blossom, because that's where it starts to make a difference. That's where you're evaluated with money tied to it, or ability to support yourself tied to it, where it starts to have meaning. It starts to become relevant, and it's also very practical. It's not just a discussion about empathy. It's not a discussion about communication. It's actually having to communicate in order to make your livelihood. It's actually encountering people in this close working environment where tensions can rise, where you do have interactions with people that you don't understand, that you haven't, you know, engaged with before, or cultures you haven't engaged with before. And that's increasingly going to be the case. I think that's one of the reasons why employers are more interested in colleges sort of seeding these kinds of soft skills in students, because, you know, these students are heading into the workplace in one of the most diverse workplaces that's ever been in this country. One that requires lots of clear, concise communication, one that requires all kinds of deep thinking and being able to think around corners. All of that comes from a deeper kind of education. And it's absolutely vital for higher education. As I said earlier in the conversation, there would be right ways and wrong ways to go about this. I think if higher education just sort of embraced that vocational side and started to discard, you know, if they just sort of said, well, the easiest pathway is to this, let's just think about guided pathways and let's think about the practical majors and let's think about where the jobs are. You're dealing with people here. I don't think that would work very well, because people, you know, the students would be dissatisfied at some level. And I think it would hamper the workplace environment overall, just to train people for specific things.
So let's talk about higher ed's ability to do this. I mean, we'll just assume, you know, if you and I tell them they should, they'll get on board, right? We know, yes, there's an election tomorrow. We're dealing with COVID right now. I mean, institutions are still pretty head down, you and I are finding, around just dealing with what's coming at them.
Yeah.
What do you think the response would be, you know, to an idea like this? Again, even if people agreed, would it be, Rick Scott, love it, come back in 2 years, you know, let's talk about it? Or actually, could higher ed start to put some of the pieces in place here? Could this actually be a way for it to deal with the short term more effectively while it's driving towards a longer term solution?
Oh, it definitely could. I think, you know, and your question, which institutions would take this on and which wouldn't, I think is one of those things that separates, you know, the institutions that carry forward versus those that don't. The institutions that are able to think a few steps ahead. You know, it is a really difficult time right now, and a lot of institutions are sort of in triage mode. But just thinking ahead that this will be one of the situations that you have to deal with, and setting up the structures to make that possible, you know, once COVID is more easy to deal with, or we understand what the spring semester is going to look like and so on, I think those institutions will be far ahead of the game. Actually, and under COVID, there's really nothing that prevents you from doing some vital work around this. I mean, you are in Annapolis, I'm here in Baltimore, we're sitting here talking, having a conversation. This is, you know, 80% of what an advisor or a staff member or career advisor would do with a student. This is what, you know, an alumnus would do with a current student when talking about a job, or what a recruiter from a company would do. And you can set this up with multiple students. I mean, this is really an opportunity to think about chances to connect students with people that are outside of the sphere of the campus, and then start to integrate them into the curriculum, into the learning process, into some of the add-ons that you do with the pedagogy.
So we said earlier we weren't focusing on the election. We were just using it as a moment to step back in terms of this point in history for higher ed. But with the election, regardless of who wins, does it matter? You know, who wins in terms of what we're talking about? Meaning, is this going to be more or less possible depending on the outcome of tomorrow?
Well, I think it will be more or less possible just based on lots of factors, but it doesn't mean that if one side or the other wins tomorrow, this can't be done, or you can't start to make progress toward this. I think one of the areas where really sort of the big federal policy will make a difference, and this is more long-term thinking rather than short-term thinking, but is what happens at the K-12 system and the K-12 system's drive toward college. And it's a big question around what we're talking about, you know, college being sort of a training ground for the job market. And I think you've probably heard me say in talks, I bring this statistic up all the time, you know, that the wage premium associated with a college degree has doubled over the past 40 years, meaning that, you know, the amount of money that you get paid as a college graduate over and above a high school graduate, that amount has doubled over the past 40 years. And it's doubled not because college graduates get paid so much more than they used to. It's doubled because high school graduates get paid so much less. So essentially, we have put that pay-to-play barrier on the job market, and that pay-to-play barrier is college. So essentially, at some level, we're saying everyone go to college, right? So the K-12 system then has been oriented around assessment, evaluation, with increasing intensity heading up into high school, which is all college prep. I think one of the things that we might want to consider as a society is pulling back on that a little bit and allowing students at these formative ages in elementary school, in middle school, in high school, really important in high school, especially early high school, for them to have the space and time to be able to mess around and fail and discover what they like or discover what they don't like. You know, I was watching recently the new David Letterman series that's on Netflix. I was watching the Jay-Z episode, actually, and Jay-Z's just fantastic, really smart guy. And he was talking about, you know, his coming up as a drug dealer and, you know, spending time writing poetry on the street and so on. And that prompted, and that was a story sort of about his hidden intellectualism. And that prompted David Letterman to tell a story of his own. And he said, well, you know, when I was growing up in Indiana, I wasn't doing very well in high school. It looked like I was going to be not a success in life. And then in my sophomore year in high school, I got a chance to take a public speaking course and I discovered I was good at it. And then off he goes. I mean, sort of the same thing happened to me. I had time in college. I had time in high school and K-12. I really wasn't the best K-12 student there was, but I was writing all the time. And teachers told me, hey, you know, take time, work for the paper, mess around. I would write stories in my spare time. I mean, this was because I wasn't distracted by a lot of other things. Either A, distracted by the phone. I mean, there's lots of electronic distractions these days. But also, you know, I watch my son who just plows through tons of work every night, a lot of tests, a lot of homework, a lot of hoop jumping, and not a lot of illumination on what he's actually good at. What he knows, I think maybe at this point, is that, oh, now I know how to just sort of complete the task. I want a little more, I mean, for that younger generation of students going into college thinking, I don't exactly know what I want to do. And maybe I don't completely have an understanding of what I'm talented at, but I do know I like to write, dance, play football, you know, do statistics, do math, whatever, and carry it from there.
So that introduces, though, a little bit of a tension point, doesn't it? If we take it back up to the higher ed level, that is, yes, we want people to discover, but we want them to be on a pathway, right? And ultimately get someplace that connects to the world of work. So even the way we think about advising, it seems to me, would need to change. Like, how do you assemble things in interesting ways that better meet industry needs? I think that takes us beyond just this pathways idea, potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it has to be high touch. I think, you know, part of that is the mentoring function that we talk about a lot in higher education. And Gallup certainly pointed out the importance of that, or at least people lauded that as one of the Gallup findings. But to what extent do we actually do a good job of that? I mean, particularly at institutions where, you know, they're trying to get the economies of scale by having a lot of students on campus and trying to reduce, you know, their costs. So maybe that means reducing their staff numbers or reducing certain kinds of services that they were providing before. We're saying you need to invest in that more. I mean, that is a difficult prospect, I think. you know, what do you do with that? I don't know. What do you think we ought to do with that?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously that's kind of our gig, right? What's the ROI behind student success or mission development? And I think we're hitting on mission and student success pretty squarely here. So, you know, one, we've seen institutions that have made the investment in better advising models, as you said earlier, it has a pretty direct translation into students staying, they take more credit hours, they are more successful. It has its own net revenue stream, it becomes its own economic engine. At the same time, you know, there's a lot of things on college campuses colleges could probably stop doing, right, and reallocate existing resources towards some of the very models that you and I are talking about. So I think the great news there is higher ed could be empowered to get its hand on the wheel here and not have to ask for authorization, permission, or new resources to start to shift in this direction.
Well, and what you find too is that, you know, among alumni, they're elated to be asked to help, you know, a young generation of students that are coming out of college, especially if it's a college that's held dear to them. So, you know, so the alumni who pop up when a college is on the verge of closing, I think administrators should try to get them to pop up a lot earlier than that and get them to pop up when the college is still doing okay or fairly well and to get involved. I mean, I think Colgate University, which has this very devoted alumni to that institution, in part, I, from what I understand, because of the geography of the place, you know, Colgate University is very isolated in upstate New York. And so the students who went there, you know, just had each other to sort of rely on. So the class identities became very, very strong. But, you know, they do that sophomore connections there, this two to three day conference where they bring back alumni to talk about their careers to the sophomores that are currently at Colgate. So many institutions can do something like that, and they can do it at low cost now through something like Zoom. It's completely possible. And I think that employers, local employers, would be willing to contribute to this as well. This is the mentoring function. This is what colleges ought to be drawing on in a lot of ways.
Well, that's probably a great place to wrap then. Higher ed serving as a bridge to the world of work, as a way to heal itself, heal the country, as another tangible way for us to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness on this early November afternoon. So Scott Carlson from the Chronicle of Higher Education, thank you for joining us. It's always a fascinating conversation when we get together. I can't wait to see what conversations lie ahead later this week and beyond, but I think we've got higher ed off to a good start. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.